Israeli technology to convert decommissioned fighter jets into unmanned drones. The report says the drones could evade Taiwanese air defenses and hit at important targets. The report comes not long after the signing of a major free trade pact between the mainland and Taiwan. But Taipei says Beijing must remove missiles before the two sides can discuss any peace accord to end 6 decades of hostilities. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Associated Press reporting a roadside bomb has killed 6 Afghan policemen in the south of the country. 4 other people were injured. Firefighters in central Washington state appear to be making some headway against a 10,000-acre fire thanks to easing winds, but 3 crew members have been injured in the process. The blaze near Yakima has burned 3 homes and threatens dozens more. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count special report addresses the importance of reading by the end of third grade at AECF.org.
On the next Fresh Air, taming the sea. Almost half of the fish we eat has been raised on farms, and genetic modification of fish is increasing. We'll talk to Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring the exhibit Helen May Butler and Her Ladies, the New American Brass Band from the Smithsonian Institute. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freitas at the controls this morning. Around the world, governments have embraced capitalism while at the same time remaining suspicious of uncontrolled free markets. And the result has been the creation of something that is relatively new, at least at the level that we see now, something called state capitalism. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll explore what many people believe will be the next big global political and economic trend, pitting competing economic systems against one another. And our guest is Ian Bremmer. He is author of a new book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is The End of the Free Market, the subtitle, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? Portfolio is the publisher. That's a division of Penguin. Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group. It's the world's leading global political risk research and consulting firm. He has written for a number of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs, and other publications. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk with Ian Bremmer, questions are welcome. We hope people will be as brief as they can. That way we'll keep moving along and to keep it at a question. But questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We also can send your questions along by email. So write to will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Bremmer, hello.
Good morning to you, sir.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Just
to start out, I want you to tell the story here that you tell in the beginning. You write here about how in May of last year, you had the chance to talk with a very highly placed government minister from China. Tell me about the question that he asked.
Yes, this is He Yafei. Funny story about He Yafei. Turned out he's the guy that when Obama went to Copenhagen and was supposed to meet the premier, the Chinese premier, who didn't show up at the last minute, He Yafei was the guy that he ended up meeting with. So the guy gets around. The question he asked me, he said, so Ian, now that the free market has failed, what do I think the appropriate role of the state in the economy should be?
And I'm sure you had to sit there for a moment just to think. Wait a minute. Now that the free market has failed,
yeah.
So that goes to the question of the title of the book, The End of the Free Market. You don't think that we are at the end of the free market?
Well, I think that we are at the end of a global free market. We've had an environment led by the G7 group of nations over the last decades where the dominant economies of the world have all supported a free market system. That's gone. I don't think it's the end of the free market for good for everyone, but the notion of a global free market, we're not in that environment anymore.
Well, I think that the question and the entire book really reflects something that a reality that you write about, that in fact we have now just fairly recently, as a result of this major economic crisis that affected many but not all countries, come to a point of major change here. You are making the argument that we have come to a major turning point.
I do believe that. I think over the course of the last several decades, multinational corporations were increasingly the dominant economic actors worldwide. And you see this in popular culture, the movies Network or RoboCop or Rollerball, and authors like Naomi Klein, No Logo. I mean, the dystopias that we imagined were these, you know, sort of fascist-type corporations that were faceless and would take over the entire world. Well, you know, what's happened in the last couple of years is that we recognize the state is back, and that the state is back even in the developed world. It's playing a much more important role. Regulation, its regulatory authority, and the rest will become more important. And, of course, that creates a political debate here in the United States. But much more meaningful at the global level is that now some of the states that are growing the fastest and doing the best out of this financial crisis and global recession, Saudi Arabia, the states of the Persian Gulf, Russia, and most importantly China, which as of this year will be the world's second largest economy, they're state capitalist systems. They're systems where the state is the principal economic actor, and they're unapologetic about that. And so here you have He Yafei, this highly placed Chinese minister, asking me with the presumption that the free market has failed. And you know, there's a lot of good politics in that kind of a quote. It's just like there's good politics in right-wingers saying that Obama's a socialist. He smiled when he said it. It was clear he was being a little cheeky, but he wasn't being entirely cheeky, and this is the world we're presently living in.
Yeah. Certainly there have been in the past large centrally planned economies. I suppose historically the biggest one would have been the Soviet Union. How is state capitalism different from what the Soviet Union was?
Well, of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and collapsed in large part because their economy just couldn't cut it, no one was paying closer attention than the government in Beijing. And what state capitalism is it's basically a rejoinder to the failure of centrally planned economies by authoritarian states that understand that they need markets. They need to use the tools of markets in order to ensure the kind of growth that is required with populations that know a lot more. They're more sophisticated than they used to be about what's happening around the world. Their expectations are growing, but it does not give up the ultimate political control of that government over the market process. So you have all of these tools of state capitalism. You have oil corporations, but they're national oil corporations, and you have a bunch of companies that exist, and some are state-owned enterprises, and some are privately owned national champions. You have hedge funds and institutional investment funds, but they're called sovereign wealth funds because they're controlled by the government. And so what you have is a system where the state is using the markets for ultimately political purposes.
Hmm. And that's really an interesting distinction there. That's not to say there aren't economic consequences, but the argument you're making is that here in these state capitalist countries that economics isn't the ultimate goal.
And, you know, let me give you a really specific example,
okay,
because sometimes these goals overlap. I mean, if you have more money than Croesus, it doesn't matter, because then you can pay for all of your priorities. So when Abu Dhabi, before the crash, was managing their sovereign wealth funds, they had Western investment managers in these state-owned funds, and they basically told them, look, just invest everywhere. Just take the money and make maximal returns, because they had everything they needed to fund all of their exciting projects within the country. Now, then you have the crash, and Dubai goes under. And at that point, they fire all of those managers, and they bring in the political leaders. And the first thing they do is bail out Dubai, and then they focus on ensuring the Emirates are safe and stable. And then they look at the Gulf around them, the Gulf states around them, and they're not thinking about maximizing return or profitability. They're using the money for political ends, because suddenly you have to make choices. And when governments have to make choices about where they put cash, then the politics and the survival of these regimes is going to be first and foremost. Mm.
And just in case people have any questions about, well, what places are we talking about here? We've mentioned Russia, mentioned China, probably now the number one state capitalist country is China?
No question. And I mean, to be fair, this book is, it's an interesting topic, but the book would not have been a big deal, and the topic would not be world-changing were it not for the fact that China is a state capitalist economy. They are, as I said, this coming year, this world's second largest economy. They're slowing down now, so their growth is only likely to be just a little over 10% this year. The U.S. has some 10% unemployment, not the same tens. And that is, you know, the United States relies on them. We have over $900 billion that we owe the Chinese directly right now. The trade deficit is very large. All Western multinationals are trying to get into that market because, you know, the United States, Europe, and Japan are growing anemically, if at all. And so clearly this is what is driving a big part of the argument. Mm.
Now, the big three countries here we're talking about in terms of state capitalism are China, Russia, Saudi Arabia. There are some other smaller countries. At least if you maybe set China aside a little bit, it seems that most of these countries, is it the case that their main assets, the things that they have to exploit, are natural resources?
Well, in fact, I'd go farther than that. I'd say you don't need to set China aside. Yeah. It's very interesting that the state capitalism is not the most efficient system in the world. And the countries that have succeeded, and many countries that have failed, with state capitalist systems, authoritarian states, and they're authoritarian states that take advantage of extraordinary resources on or in the ground. They can be oil, it can be gas, it can be hard commodities, or it can be labor. And in the case of China, it's this extraordinary labor pool, 1.3 billion strong, that are massively productive and are, compared to other countries in the world, quite inexpensive.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Ian Bremmer, and we are talking about his book, The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? That's the subtitle. He is president of Eurasia Group. It is a global political risk research and consulting firm. He's also written for a number of publications, among them Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs. His new book is just out. It's published by Portfolio. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. I will raise a point before some caller does, and we may still have people who want to talk about it. There are, I'm sure, people who will make the argument that in the West, in the developed world, and in the United States, we don't truly have a free market, at least in this respect. They would argue that government and business elites are all entangled. They work for each other's benefit. So I'm sure some people would make the argument that that is, in fact, a form, maybe not as strong a form, but is a form of state capitalism.
I would disagree strongly for a couple reasons. First, let me make the sort of the consistent argument with where we've been so far, which is that in the United States and other developed states, you actually have rule of law. And so as a consequence, if you get angry at AIG, you get when Obama was, outraged, he decided that he wasn't going to rip up those bonuses and those contracts, and neither did Congress, even though it was indeed outrageous that they made that money, because we were going to get lawyered up in this country, and it was going to be years, if not decades, before that got resolved. You have the same problem in China. You don't get lawyered up. You get Googled out. You don't want to be on the wrong side of the state. There's no process. So that's the first, the big difference. But the second big difference is, I think, interesting. I agree that the United States and indeed many developed states have moved away from a free market over the last couple of decades. But they've not moved away from a free market towards state capitalism. They've moved away towards hypercapitalism. A free market doesn't mean the government doesn't exist or that the government plays no role. And just as I argue in the book that it is inefficient for states to control corporations, It is also a very unfortunate thing when corporations control states, when they capture states. You create different problems. In a state capitalist society, you tend to smooth out volatility and bubbles. The state has much more control, and you create very large bubbles, much larger unsustainable bubble later on. You create more unsustainability long term. When the corporations capture states, whether you're talking about oil drilling or whether you're talking about finance, or even whether you're talking about U.S. multinationals investing in China and bringing their technology over, you're talking about maximizing short-term profitability and compensation and paying no attention to risk, no attention to externalities like the U.S. taxpayer. And the fact that the United States just chose, for various reasons, not to regulate in any effective way multinationals operating in the U.S. in several key sectors is not, in my view, a failure of the free market. It is a failure of regulation, and it is corporations in some sectors actually capturing the state.
Hmm. Real quick, let me ask you one more question. I have a couple of callers here. We'll start to get to see what's on the minds of people who are listening. We talked a little earlier about the fact that right now, right at the moment, these state-driven economies are actually doing better than the world's free market countries, and that was a major change. At the same time, though, when you ask the question for state capitalist, big state capitalist countries like China, for example, what's the potential for the longer term?
It's I think that depends on what longer term is. I mean, certainly what's happened in the last 2 years has given the Chinese government a longer lease on life than they otherwise would have, no matter what your projection was. I mean, let's face it, with 30 years of state-driven 10% plus growth, the Beijing Olympics, the Shanghai Expo, and the West in disarray, the average Chinese is very happy with their government right now, and they're very happy with how they're doing as a country, much more so than the Americans are with the U.S. government or the Brits with their new British government or the Germans or the Japanese or the Greeks, you know, if you really want to start bottom fishing. But longer term, the sustainability of the Chinese model is open to question, and I do believe that it's going to be a lot more difficult for them, in part because as Western corporations are increasingly unwilling to bring technology over to that country because it gets stolen, and we've heard such statements from Jeff Immelt of GE and Steve Ballmer of Microsoft just in the last few weeks, not small industrialists themselves, that the Chinese ability to develop their own innovations and their own technology will be very constrained. The educational system isn't oriented towards it, neither is the political and economic system. As their demographics start to turn against them, Chinese labor is going to become less competitive, and that's going to squeeze them to a very great degree. Their environment is being destroyed much faster than anything else we've ever seen in the industrializing world in terms of water availability, land quality, and the rest. And commodities are becoming increasingly scarce, and the Chinese will be fighting with other countries like India, whose economy is becoming more commodities dependent as it grows. All of those things are going to put a massive squeeze on China, not in the next 2 or 3 years, but as we look out 5, 10, 20 years, I think that the unsustainability of Chinese state capitalism is going to become much more evident.
Just to get to the point about the difficulties that outsiders face competing in these markets, the complaint is, as you say, that, well, first of all, they would say there's no such thing as a level playing field because the domestic industries, whether they're state or private, are favored. And as you say, there may be a whole raft of issues having to deal with rule of law, with intellectual property, and so forth. Is that something, though, that if they wanted to, these governments could address and maybe make things a little bit more attractive for outside business and yet essentially maintain the character of their systems? Or if you do that, then then really are you no longer talking about state capitalism?
Well, no, you can address it, and you do address it in some cases. I mean, it's not as if the West can never invest in state capitalist countries. If you look at a place like Saudi Arabia, it is largely an oil-driven economy. I mean, for them, when you ask them about diversification of their economy, they've historically talked about petrochemicals, not exactly a different sector. Mm-hmm. But the Saudis now want a banking sector, they want a healthcare sector, they want technology, and there are no local companies doing it. They're low in labor. They have to import a lot of their labor. So if they want to develop that, they're going to need Western firms for the long term. Now, there's no transparency in Saudi Arabia. It's completely opaque in terms of the nature of contract law and the rest. But if the Saudis need you and they continue to need you, well, you probably don't want to upset a prince. That's usually never a good idea in one of these countries. But generally speaking, there are lots of reasons to believe you'll do well for a long term. The problem in China is that they no longer need foreign investment dollars. They don't need capital at all. They do need technology, but it's higher levels of technology that the West is increasingly loath to bring, and they no longer believe that exporting stuff to the West is an appropriate model for them to ensure their own growth, because we just can't afford to buy their stuff. And so as a consequence, their new strategy is we need to diversify our exports away from the West. We need to innovate domestically so we keep a larger percent of the profits of what we do produce in China. And we need to develop domestic consumption. In other words, we need to decouple from these economies and these investors in the West. Well, that is a serious problem for Western multinationals. So while Hillary Clinton can go over to China all she likes and say we want a level playing field ain't happening from the perspective of the Chinese government. It doesn't make sense to ensure their own sustainability and survival as a government.
We have callers, and we will start right in, and again, hope that people can be brief. That'll make possible for us to get in as many callers as possible. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Also, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take them in the order they came in. First, line one. Hello.
Yes. I remember learning once upon a time that the fascist states of Europe, Germany and Italy and so forth, before the Second World War, being described as state capitalist. In your terms, is that accurate? And if so, does that have any implications about possible problems in the political future of the countries that you've been talking about?
Well, no, I would say that was a precursor. The term has been used a lot. The most appropriate precursor were probably the mercantilist societies that we saw in Europe back in the 18th century, and I talk about that a fair amount in the book. Do I think that there is going to be an ideological problem as a consequence of where the state capitalist system goes? Well, I do. I don't think it's endemic to state capitalism. I think it's endemic to authoritarianism. So If you're one of these governments and it starts to fall apart, you have two choices. You can either start moving back towards a more efficient, more open, more transparent system, go back towards the West and get support, get investment, and all the rest, which is dangerous to do because it means you lose a lot more power over economic controls and mechanisms as the state, and especially if you think about going into higher levels of technology, going into service sectors, really building out consumption, well, those things are less state involved. They involve a lot more individual will and decision making by your population. Or you can go the heavy-handed route. You can say, we need to crack down, we need to be repressive, and we need to blame the West. We need to use nationalism, we need to use xenophobia, and create something that could well have much more dire manifestations for conflict globally. There's a country right now that's facing this problem, Venezuela. Venezuela, state capitalist country, very poorly run. They run a deficit when oil prices are under $85 to $90 a barrel. Chavez has systematically destroyed that economy, and he's losing a lot of support, not just among his own people, but also among his military. Now, he's got a couple choices. He can try to open up towards the West, but the West has already been fooled many times by Chavez, and they're not willing to just jump right back in and start investing money. or Chavez can try to seriously crack down. I suspect he'll take that route. But in Venezuela, without a really strong base of support from even within the military, I think Chavez will just be forced out of office. But there's no question that in some of these countries, we're likely to see, as the state capitalist system starts becoming more problematic for them, we're going to see much more dangers of international conflict as a consequence.
In particular, I would guess that you would not consider India to currently be an authoritarian country.
I don't.
But if they're state capitalist, does that mean that they're going to face this in the future and might tend to become authoritarian?
Well, I don't think they are state capitalist. I think that, if anything, I mean, you have to, of course, with developing countries, rule of law is not as strong. The political institutions aren't as stable. I think India's issue is not that it's state capitalist, that it's massively decentralized, so that irrespective of what kind of agreements as a corporation you might get when you visit New Delhi, the local bureaucrats are very powerful and they're massively corrupt. This is a badly functioning, relatively free market system as opposed to a well-functioning state capitalist one. Now, it's interesting, in part because they're not state capitalist, when the Indians go up against the Chinese to try to lock up commodities in places like Africa and Central Asia, or in investment contracts and trade contracts in Sri Lanka after the war was over last year, they lose. They lose consistently. And it is quite possible the Indian government will say they need a stronger industrial policy and maybe move towards state capitalism simply to compete with the Chinese longer term. That will be interesting, and if that happens, you'll see a move towards a stronger Indian state. But I think there's no danger, really, given the nature of the Indian governmental structure, that we're going to see a very significant or dramatic move in that direction.
This is all very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go on next to caller on line number two. Hello.
Well, I'll disagree with the last caller. I don't find it very interesting. I find it very typical, actually, of the line that we hear. I am one of the number the host described earlier as regarding the U.S. as not having a free market for quite a while. Even some conservative theorists in the early days, the hidden hand of the market, were warning about combines, and that's another word for corporate power, and corporate power is the defining thing of the time. The Eisenhower, radical, warned about the military-industrial complex. The question is, how can you look at the military Keynesianism, a term that I've used in arguments before and with conservative economists, and some of them claim to not even know what I'm talking about, but Pentagon capitalism has just been described. It's clearly how sovereign funds of the U.S. are used to affect the economy, and they've done it in very terrible and awful ways. The capture of the Pentagon budget has gone to the extent that there's so many private contractors. I'm not talking about Blackwater. I'm talking about SAIC and all of the other firms that are I can't think of the pig metaphor that I'm trying to use.
The trough?
Yes, feeding at the trough. So, I just disagree with you entirely. I don't think you're elucidating anything. I think this is a convenient way of attacking the Chinese, and the Chinese surely should be attacked for human rights. But if you look at the amount of money they spend on the military, it's dwarfed by the percentage that the U.S. Does, and that is certainly the way sovereign funds and state capitalism has operated in the U.S.
Well, Mr. Bremer, you want to respond?
Well, the caller may have missed the piece when I was talking about the danger of states being captured by corporations, which is certainly something I think is a danger and has happened in the United States to the neglect of the U.S. Taxpayer. I mean, when you see Goldman Sachs and other banks with CDOs on CDOs because they want shareholder returns that are short-term and because they want compensation, executive compensation, which is short-term because they're blown out of there in 10 years and they don't care. Or when you see BP or other oil corporations that are drilling and tell the Congress bald-facedly, we have no way of stopping this sort of drill accidents once they occur, and we wrote our reports because the regulators said we had to, but we didn't really mean it, that implies that there's something fundamentally broken in the way that the U.S. economy is presently running, at least in some sectors. Now, that is not state capitalism, but that is certainly corporatism. It's certainly corporations actively subverting the process. And I think that unlike in Canada, and unlike even in Britain, the power of the U.S. corporate lobbies is very, very large indeed. And I've gotten a lot of people on the other side of it. I mean, the fellow that just called is obviously representing a strong ideological perspective, which I'm not very interested in. I've gotten people from the other side of the ideological spectrum saying Obama's a socialist, and look at what he's trying to accomplish. He's subverting all the corporations. That's also ridiculous. The fact is that corporations in America probably have more of a free hand to do what they want than in any other developed state. And even with the significant regulatory legislation which is now going through on the financials and what we will see on the oil companies, that will still be true. And American corporations will still prefer to be domiciled in the U.S. They won't move, even though American tax rates will probably be larger than in other countries, in part because of the advantages the U.S. has for entrepreneurship and, you know, research budgets and all the rest, but in part because the system is favorable to them. That's a very, very different system, and it's a different set of problems than the ones we have with state capitalism. The state capitalist issue, though, is one that is facing the entire West, not just the United States. And I think that it's one that hasn't been described or discussed very much, while the one that your caller just brought up, the issue of, you know, the military-industrial complex being powerful, is one we've heard time and time again for decades.
I need to jump in here. We're past our midpoint. I have another caller who's been waiting patiently. I want to get on to it. And I also need to just do a quick mention of some weather information. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect until 5 o'clock this afternoon for parts of central Illinois. There's a chance of hail, thunderstorm winds, and dangerous lightning, and these counties are included. These are the counties in our severe weather coverage area that are included: DeWitt, Macon, Moultrie, and Piatt. So again, that's until 5 o'clock this evening. And I do again want to introduce our guest for this hour of focus. We're talking with Ian Bremmer. He is president of Eurasia Group. It is the world's leading global political risk research and consulting firm. And he is the author of a new book. And if you want to read more on the subject, that you want to look at The End of the Free Market, the subtitle is Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. It's published by Portfolio. That is a division of Penguin. He's also written for Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs, other publications. And he's joining us by phone. And questions welcome. We do want to get on here to another caller. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go to our toll free line next, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. My name is Michael, by the way. I'm going to start doing that.
Hi, Michael.
Yes. And my question is, I hear these programs regularly and read and research and such, and what's being described here are symptoms. And I've used that metaphor before because the symptoms of what is life is, and what the diseases are and what the cures might be. And my question to you is, how is it sustainable? We have 7.2 billion people on this earth or thereabouts, and projected to 12, where the system can support that many people. And I'm dubious about the natural resources and the capitalist system that is engaged in executing the sustainability of life of the species on this planet, plus the planet itself. How much longer can all that continue to treat the negative symptoms that capitalism and consumerism has become? And in places like China and India, can everybody drive a car? Can everybody have electrical appliances and the sulfurized coal in China that is?
And the answer is they can't. And that's one of the reasons that I'm so skeptical about Chinese growth. I mean, if you think that capitalism is unsustainable, and it may well be, State capitalism is even more unsustainable. I mean, you know, everyone says they need 8% growth every year just to stay in office. Now, that may be a high figure. That's a consensus among the economists. But the Chinese government's acting like it's true. And over 75% of their electricity comes from coal. Now, I know that they're spending like crazy to develop green technology and green jobs, they're doing as much as they can, but it's not anywhere close to enough. And they all want cars because we got cars. And, you know, we got to industrialize. Why don't they? Well, because there's 1.3 billion of them, and there's 1.1 billion in India. They just don't get cars, not until there's effective battery technology that's clean, and we're not close to that. So, you know, the fact is that this stuff is unsustainable, and it's going to cause big problems. It's going to cause bigger problems among the state capitalists, where the system's very survival is at stake. I mean, you know, capitalist countries, believe it or not, can survive on zero growth. You look at Japan. Maybe Japan's teaching us all a lesson. I mean, you know, no one in the investment community is excited about Japan as a market because it's been anemic for 30 years. But you know what? They also haven't been emitting more over the last 20 years, and they haven't been consuming much more. So a lot of people don't want to invest, but the Japanese people seem relatively content with a pretty wealthy lifestyle, pretty anemic demographics, right? The economy, the numbers of folks in Japan is actually shrinking a little bit, and their compensation doesn't really go anywhere year in, year out, but they don't seem particularly less happy than the average American. So, you know, clearly, if you think about the environment and climate, and you think about you know, sort of where both consumerism but also state capitalism gets you, you end up with some fairly audacious conclusions, and sustainability is absolutely one.
Again, I want to thank the caller and go on to the next, and that's back here to line number one. Hello.
Hello. I get the impression that a totalitarian society, our government, is so restraining and inhibitive to the citizenry that they cannot be inventive. They do not have the initiative or even the means to put together an entrepreneurship type of society. While they may be well in copying things, they're very inhibited to inventiveness, which is, of course, such an important
factor. You're talking about China?
Yes. Any totalitarian society.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no question. I mean, those are authoritarian states, totalitarian, where you have no investment and no markets, or something like North Korea, even less so. But you know, the Chinese educational system, in part because of the way it was established, is really based much more on rote, on memorization. And it's really, really effective at getting a whole bunch of people to work to management plans. It's not so effective in taking local initiative and being entrepreneurial. And yes, they've been really good at reverse engineering Western technology, figuring out how to apply it themselves and effectively copying it or tweaking it. They've not been so great at developing their own innovation. And I suspect you need to change their political and economic system before you can really make them great at sustaining entrepreneurship. And that's something the United States really has as an advantage in spades. Now, the U.S. does other stupid things, which is we allow tens of thousands of Chinese to come over here and get their PhDs at some of the world's best institutions, and then we won't give them visas. We send them back, and I understand there's an employment issue in the United States, but in terms of long-term growth and competitiveness in the U.S., we should want these people staying in America, getting married to Americans, and being entrepreneurial in the United States of America. And, you know, if they go back to China in 20 years' time, they can help bring some of the ideas about why the U.S. is a good system. That would be smarter, but, you know, with 17.2% real unemployment right now in America, a lot of Americans are hurting. And they don't want to hear open borders and immigration. They certainly aren't voting that way if you look at the polls on Arizona right now. They don't want to hear about free trade. And that's unfortunate because we are in an environment where it's very difficult for political leaders to stand up and support the baseline principles of the free market. We got ourselves into this fix. But it's going to be tough to get ourselves out of it.
Yeah. Here's an email that has come in, and I think you've touched on this, but I again, just in case you have anything extra to say, The listeners interested in how demographics play into this equation makes reference to a recent book, The Next 100 Million, which takes a look at what's happening in world population. That book apparently anticipates 400 million Americans by mid-century, although the listener here is thinking about China, and apparently what happens there with population and the demands of increased population, but then also the ability of workers there in China to meet the demands of the domestic population.
Yeah, and you know, China's increasingly becoming two countries. You have folks, workers on the coast that make over $5,000 a year who are starting to spend like folks in advanced emerging markets. They're becoming much more savvy and sophisticated about what their needs and desires are, and they're demonstrating and forming unions accordingly. And then folks in the interior country, many of whom make under $1,000 a year, who are like the Chinese development that we saw over the last 20, 30 years. There's going to be massive investment in bringing these people up the value chain. For now, China's okay, but the demographics will start to turn against them in 5 to 10 years, and it's going to start squeezing them. It's going to start squeezing them pretty hard. They also, of course, have a gender imbalance because of the one-child policy, where many, many unwanted female fetuses, in some cases infants, were removed from the population quite forcibly. And that means you now have lots of men coming up in society that were raised as only children, and anyone that's ever dated an only child understands the horrors of that situation, they won't have, a lot of them will not have opportunities to find wives, and it's one reason the Chinese export a lot of labor, in addition to capital, when they invest in Africa, which causes instability because those local populations want jobs. And it's going to cause instability and aggression within China itself. So there are lots of moving parts. I mean, if anything, I think, you know, we're getting from this conversation, it's the complexities the Chinese government has to try to deal with as it tries to manage, you know, this extraordinary burgeoning economy.
Hmm. Is there I wonder whether, in fact, there would be some countries, and I guess my model here would be a small country that is underdeveloped but is rich in resources. I'm sure some people make the argument, in fact, maybe for a country like that, state capitalism would be the best way to go, particularly if the alternative was inviting in outsiders to run that resource exploitation for you and end up than being the exploiters.
Oh, that's right. And I mean, if you're a tiny country, you know, you want to talk about being captured by a corporation. I mean, the governments will have very, very little say, and they get exploited. And typically, the response is, well, we just want to take over these resources for ourselves. Now, most of those economies have not ended up running well because the folks that take over those countries become kleptocrats and they form deals with corporations, and the people end up getting shafted. And we've seen a lot of that, of course, throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Equatorial Guinea is a good example of that, a particularly unfortunate example of that. But there are many others. Having said that, there are small countries that are authoritarian and state capitalists that are relatively well-run. Abu Dhabi is probably one of them. It's a very small population. The local Emiratis are a minority of the population. They import a lot of labor. They have extraordinary oil wealth, and they're able to take advantage of that. I mean, if you're incredibly wealthy, you can have a lot of political systems that probably won't get you ousted, as long as you're providing the goods for all of your people.
Our guest in this hour again, Ian Bremmer. He is the author of the recent book, The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations, published by Portfolio. We have about 8 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, how now do you suggest that the Western industrialized market capitalist countries meet this challenge?
Well, I think that we don't want to go down the path of a trade war, of a tit-for-tat system. I think the most important thing is for the Americans to be indispensable. And we've had so much talk about too big to fail, Bank of America too big to fail, Citigroup too big to fail. Now, America needs to be too big to fail. The danger we have is that the Chinese look at the Americans and they say, wow, we're not sure we believe in the system long term. Hence the question from that Chinese minister that we had right at the beginning, well, you know, the free market has failed. We don't want them to think the free market's failed. We want them to think that the free market is going to be vibrant, and so they need to invest here. We need them to invest so much here and put so much money into U.S. Treasuries that if we start to go down, they get hurt even more. You know, $900 billion that we owe the Chinese, that's not our problem right now. It's their problem. And we should want them to invest more. Now, we need to get our fiscal house in order. There's no question. We need to start, you know, sort of only spending within our means. And the rampant consumption that's occurred in the U.S. is going to have to be toned down for a long time. I don't think we're getting back to where we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But we do need to spend judiciously in those areas that will make a difference for us long term. And that means research and development. That means alternative energy and new technologies. It means that we need to continue to spend on our educational system for ourselves and for the best and brightest all over the world. And it means we need to push for free markets. And if the Chinese refuse to accept that, then we should develop free markets and free trade in other places, like in South Korea, where we should get that free trade agreement done, like in Japan, where we should get that free trade agreement done. And we need to avoid, we need to do everything we can to stop corporations being able to capture states, which ultimately isn't even in the corporation's interest. Now, this is something we need to recognize. Corporate CEOs are not interested in free markets, if you ask them honestly. And if you ask me honestly, I run a political risk firm. I would like to, I mean, if you came up to me as the head of that firm and said, Ian, what kind of regulation would you like on your industry? I'm sure I'd love to be a monopoly. So I could be the only political risk firm out there, and you have to turn to me. That would be great for our employees, but it's not good for the economy. And the fact is that at BP or ExxonMobil or any of the other oil companies or any of the banks, their executives would say the same thing, which is the reason why, yeah, we don't want the state to own those corporations because they'd run them badly. We don't want them to even take large equity stakes. But they do need to be effective regulators. They can't be asleep at the switch, and that's where they've been for the last couple of decades. And so, you know, we have to, you know, much as America doesn't like big government, anything that smacks of big government, we're going to need to pay attention to effective regulation, and in some places that's going to expand the role of government from where it's been in the last 20 years.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We'll try to squeeze one more caller in here, somebody on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. I was just wondering how the role of monetary policy fits in to this scenario. You know, there's so much debt in all the nations now. Do you think that's sustainable, or will currency survive, national currency survive?
Well, it's much more sustainable for the U.S. than it is for the euro or the yen, which are both running much more massive problems in terms of fiscal debt to GDP ratios. I think national currencies will survive. I think the euro will actually survive simply because the bureaucrats will resist anything that moves away from it, but it's going to continue to have a lot of downward pressure. I just got back from Britain last week, and I got to tell you, if there's one good story in Europe right now, it's the British elections, not just who won, which is, you know, it depends on your preferences, but the way they held the election. Very boring election from the American perspective. Liberal, Democratic Party, Labor, and Conservatives all talking only about fiscal policy, and they didn't disagree that much because they recognized they need to do something. So I think the Europeans are starting to take this seriously now, and they're going to need to for some years. The Americans, we have much more fiscal rope to hang ourselves with, but we do seem intent on using it. And, you know, I know that there's this fiscal deficit commission, bipartisan, that's going to start making its recommendations in December, right after elections, of course. Let's see how seriously they're taken. I mean, the U.S. is going to need to start really paying attention to this issue, and it's not clear to me that we've quite gotten that joke yet.
Yeah. Well, I just, and I'm glad the caller sort of gets us to this question, and I did want to raise the issue of Europe, even though it seems maybe a little peripheral, but to have you talk about how it is that what's been happening now in Europe with this move toward economic unification, have some kind of consensus on economic policy. It doesn't mean central planning, but some consensus. And of course, that we have a number of countries that have adopted the common currency. How much longer that's going to hold together the Eurozone, we don't exactly know. But how does Europe fit into all of this?
Well, Europe fits in because, the United States is going to have a very hard time getting an effective partner out of the Eurozone to promote a lot of the policies that I was talking about, because Europe is focused on nothing but their own domestic problems right now. And that is an issue. I mean, you know, at the same time that you desperately need global coordination, governance, and leadership on things like trade and climate, you have overwhelming focus by all of the developed countries that would be in a position to do something on their own economic problems. And these aren't short-term issues. These guys are going to have their eyes off that ball for years. Again, I think the Eurozone stays together, and I think it stays together because it has a lot of bureaucratic buffers that will stop any referenda from actually leaving the Eurozone from actually transpiring. But the problems are severe, and the German economy is doing very well right now, actually. Believe it or not, unemployment's down, but it's not helping Merkel. Her numbers are still down because nobody wants to continue to see the Germans bailing out the Greeks and the rest. And it's just not popular domestically. I mean, I'm sitting here in New York, and I don't think the citizens of New York would be very interested in bailing out Illinois, which almost looks like makes New York look like a good story nowadays. But it's a lot worse when you look at the Brits versus the Greeks, or the Germans versus the Portuguese, and that is the danger, of course, is that you've got a Eurozone, but there isn't a shared loyalty to Brussels.
Yeah. Well, just one other thing that I think was interesting, and I saw you in a little interview that I looked at, you said something I thought was really interesting, that you think in the future, though, that we should expect to see a world that is more economically multipolar, and that we're going to see more and more big regional kind of economic cooperation zones?
Yes. I think at the absence of global cooperation, and I think the G20 is fundamentally like the Security Council, nothing happens there, you will see more large powers getting together with their neighbors, and you'll see more regional capital flows and trade flows. That's most obvious in Asia around China, and you'll see many countries coming towards China like Taiwan has. But Vietnam and Southeast Asia as a whole, all of the rest, you're starting to see more of it in Russia, Eurasia, with countries like Ukraine, for example, reintegrating towards Russia, Central Asia states. And you're going to see it in the Gulf with a stronger Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC. You're definitely going to see stronger regionalism. And in that context, I think there's nothing to worry about on the NAFTA front.
And so even more on that, though, in terms of kind of economic cooperation in the Americas?
I suspect we will eventually see that, but of course, the Americas as opposed to NAFTA is a little bit harder. Brazil's such an open zone; everyone wants in. China is Brazil's leading trade partner right now. The U.S. has taken their eye off the ball a little bit on Brazil for a while, and we'll see where that's going to go.
Yeah. One more trip back to the theme of the book, I guess, for anybody who says, is this Cold War II now simply being fought on economic terms?
No, it's not a Cold War, and the reason it isn't is because it's not just zero sum. The Cold War, we win, Soviets lose, and vice versa. Here we're fighting against a country we actually need. American corporations desperately need to be able to invest in China, and we need the Chinese to continue to spend money with the United States and buy our treasuries. The problem is the Chinese don't think they need us quite as much in the long term, and the power, the relative power of these two systems is changing very dramatically. So, it's much more like a marriage becoming more confrontational than it is a Cold War.
Well, our guest, Ian Bremmer, he's president of Eurasia Group. He's written for Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs, other publications. His new book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. The publisher is Portfolio. That's a division of Penguin. And Mr. Bremmer, thank you very much.
My pleasure being with you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
And just a reminder that anytime you like, you can listen through your computer. We're there live, but you can also go to the web archive. Maybe there's some past programs that you'd like to listen to, programs from Focus, Afternoon Magazine, local news production is there. There's a lot of material there, and it's ready anytime that you're ready to listen. So if you haven't looked at our website, why don't you take a look? It's WILL, W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. That is it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more in the way of news, weather, other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And hosting today, Tom Rogers.
Thanks, David, and good morning or good afternoon. The Afternoon Magazine comes your way after NPR News. We'll take a look at the BBC Europe Today. And coming up at the 12:40 segment of the Afternoon Magazine, an interview or a discussion around the famous Irish tenor John McCormick, who is one of NPR's special voices that we've been portraying on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. That's coming up in about 45 minutes on the Afternoon Magazine. Well, the weather has become a hot item, and an improvement in the weather forecast has brought commodity prices down pretty much across the board. The current numbers, as we see in Kansas City, the September winter wheat contract is down 3 1/4 cents at 5.95 3/4. In Chicago, September wheat is at 5.81 3/4, down 5.5 cents. December off 5 at 6.11. In the corn pit, the September contract is down 11 3/4 cents a bushel at 3.83. The corn is off on one of its longest, largest drops in some time. And that has pretty much spurred downward trading in the rest of the market. December corn right now is down 11.5 cents at 3.95 3/4. March of next year at 4.07 1/4, down 10.5 cents. Crude oil is up 48 cents a barrel at 76.48. In the bean complex, August beans are at 10.08 1/2, down 11. September down 12.5 at 9.85 1/2. It's November beans at 9.71 1/2, down 13.5. Soybean meal for August, 303.60, off 4.20. Bean oil is down 20 cents at 38.11. Live cattle for August at 93.25, up 97.5. Feeders for August, 113.80, up 70. Lean hogs for